Hello and welcome to the Open Air Podcast. My name is Devang Desai and I'm joined as always by Mr. Simon Bushell. Bush, still in the UK, off the grid for almost 5 days. How was it?
Interesting. It's been very interesting as a week when you have basically no access to the internet. It's a remarkable change of scenery when your life is so revolving around being plugged in constantly. It's been really nice. I've got to spend the last 3 days with my niece, who is just turning 2 years old, so got away from everything for a few days, but it has made getting access to watching tennis quite challenging. Although I wouldn't be a tennis junkie without at least keeping up with everything throughout the week. So rest assured, everyone, I'm up on everything.
He's on it.
Unbelievable.
He's on it.
Despite being away from everything, I've still managed to do it.
Not the most confidence boosting words I've heard in terms of he's on it, but in case you are not on it, Simon, we are in luck. We have a guest with us this week, Amy Lundy. You know her from her work with Tennis Congress, 538, ESPN.com. Last word on tennis, as well as her work on YouTube channel 3, which is awesome, recapping all the big tennis events just like us, but I highly recommend subscribing to that show. Amy, how's it going?
Great. Very chilled out today, so it's going to be fun to talk tennis with you guys.
It is, and I think chill out is the word of the day, because we're a week removed from a pretty wild US Open, and though it was a week ago Sunday when Daniil Medvedev stunned a lot of people, including us, it feels somehow like it was longer ago, like somehow we have just left the US Open behind and we need to re-examine it this quickly. But it just happened. That being said, Amy, we're a week removed. What is left with you today as we sit here and talk about that tournament and just how special it was?
It was intense on both sides, the men and the women. I think I'm still kind of recovering from the year that Djokovic had and the story, the journey, and trying to figure out what happened in that last final, and also reflecting quite a bit on the fact that here in the US, and please forgive me for being US centric, no, but here in the US, we had higher TV ratings for the women's final than the men's, which is, you know, fairly unusual. It's happened before. But reflecting on why that was and the popularity of each, the men's and the women's tennis going forward, and what really draws and compels people to watch?
It's a great question, because I think we had almost exactly opposite stories. On the women's side, two teenagers just bursting onto the scene miraculously. Again, something that we haven't seen in so long. And on the men's side, something that we kind of saw coming or expected to happen for so long. And I wonder if that has something to do with the TV numbers as well and NFL football starting back on Sunday. I've seen that reason being bandied about. But I almost wonder if it is a case of the unexpected on the Saturday with Layla and Emma and just the weirdness of it all and having this final take place met with, okay, Novak should probably win this. And even though he was stunned, it happened so quickly that we weren't even able to latch on to a five-setter that goes deep into the night. And I wonder if that had a role to play as well.
I think the way that the men's match unfolded probably brought the rating down. But, you know, the NFL, I mean, it's that way every year. It's right. We have this scenario. I'm a big proponent of, like, get the U.S. Open away from the NFL. But that's, you know, again, a very U.S.-centric point of view. But it is the U.S. Open. But, you know, scheduling aside, I think Medvedev is a real question mark as to whether he's going to be this huge draw and this huge personality in tennis, and people are like drawn to tune in to watch this guy, because he's got certain aspects of his personality that are a lot of fun, like the way he celebrated and, you know, did the dead fish thing and all that. But his game itself is, I've had several casual tennis fans tell me that they're a little bored just watching the baseline redirect kind of game. Mm-hmm. So that may have pulled it down. If you see that Djokovic dropped the first two sets, that may have pulled it down. The fact that it is Novak and he's arguably the least popular of the big three, but still quite popular. But, you know, that may have brought it down. It's hard to say, but, you know, looking at the women's side, I do think that we have two young, very interesting competitors here, potentially very good for that side of the sport. Exciting. So that was pretty cool. And it was fun to watch both their runs through that tournament.
Emma Raducanu just landing in the UK recently. That's how whirlwind this whole week has been. I think she's at the Met Gala as well, which we'll talk about. But Bush, since that time now, what is the conversation like in the UK? And I'm also curious if you can piggyback on Amy's point about Med's watchability, because I think that is the question we'll have to talk about going forward.
Still glued to the back pages. Nothing's changed in the space of a week. Still the darling of the nation of Chu, which I guess is not entirely surprising, just given we've waited 44 years for another women's champion at Grand Slam level. This one's going to stick around for a while. And for a number of reasons, not least the fact that the nation of Britain actually is a tennis-mad nation. It's strange to believe, but no matter where you go, you will find tennis courts. There is problems, of course, within the system, and we could have a podcast for 10 hours to talk about the LTA, but in general, it is still a nation that loves its tennis, and Wimbledon is the crown jewel of that. I think Amy makes some really interesting points in regards to the numbers and the viewership numbers, and this one's very stark because I was doing some digging myself, and the women's semi-final numbers actually higher as well than the men's semi-finals with regards to both matches as well. And the NFL didn't bump up against those either. So that is an excuse that is, I think, been trotted out. And I think it's in some ways is quite false, but it's one of those that it's just a, I think it's an indictment in some ways of Novak Djokovic's sort of standing in the sport in some capacity, because this is a dude that's going for history. Like this is the, this is it, right? This is the pinnacle of everything that US audiences and audiences around the world should be gluing their eyes to the TV to watch this. And the fact that it did so poorly, yes, you can talk about it doing alongside the NFL, but in general, there is an expectation that if you're going for four, if you're going for 21, if you're going for history, you can't get a bigger narrative than this. And he still didn't get that draw. It's really interesting to sort of unpack that and figure out why that was the case. I think we all know why it's the case on the women's side, because you have two teenagers who are awesome. It's that straightforward and it's that simple. And it's a really easy narrative for everyone to get behind. So that's the most, I think, the most straightforward argument that I can make about the whole thing. But it is a really fascinating week in terms of those statistics when it comes to the viewership numbers.
And based on who was there, Medvedev was the best guy to have in the final for that kind of theater-like setup for Novak going for history. So in terms of who was available in the field, who wasn't there, plenty to unpack for sure. Just on that WTA generation and Fernandez and Raducanu, Clara Tauson won today as we record in Luxembourg, beating Elena Ostapenko. She's 18 and she's won two titles this year as well. She's the fifth woman to do that on the WTA. She'll rise to 52 in the rankings, but there's another one. So you have three teenagers now, and Clara Tauson's had a really strong year. This isn't just her popping up now, but we have three teens now who are fully in the conversation going forward in the big tournaments. I wonder if you guys have theories as to why we see the parity in the WTA now, or, and maybe coupled with that, a younger crop of players winning more, because I think Coco Gauff got the hype and we talk about the American lens and looking at it through her rise. But alongside her, there's quite a few players, Amy, who are young and really good right now.
Yeah. And I'm one of these people that I'll just speak my mind. I don't think parity, quote unquote, is a good thing. I don't think it's great for the sport when you have a bunch of people winning just one slam, because that doesn't create the rivalries and people forget about that person. And I mean, guys, I have seen it a million times in the women's game over the last few years. People get really excited about one player, Andreescu, or Swiatek, or, you know, whoever, Ostapenko, whoever it is, and then that player will not win another slam. And it's not entirely their fault, you know, they're doing the best they can, but I personally think that the best of three format has something to do with that, because I think best of five creates superstars, while best of three can kind of promote some random results. But I don't want to get all excited about a certain player and then just have that player do nothing for the next 10 years. So I don't really think that parity, quote unquote, is a great sort of deal to have. So every time I see someone who has true superstar potential like Raducanu, I kind of hope for the sport that she continues to do well. Osaka broke through, Barty broke through, and those two do, I mean, they are superstars, because the four elements that I think you need are, you need an interesting backstory, you need an interesting game, you need an engaging personality, and you need to win multiple slams. So if you can do those four things, then you become the superstar that makes $50 million like Naomi Osaka does. And it's good for the sport, because then rivalries can develop behind that. So I'm really hoping that Raducanu, you know, can follow this path, because she's got pretty much all the elements there.
Just to piggyback on that as well, Simon, do you agree with Amy? Do you think Emma is probably the leader in the clubhouse in terms of these three teams going forward, in terms of making it count and winning again? Because I think it's fair to mention that. And I think we've talked about Bianca Andreescu at length and the injury questions, and a whole lot of stuff has happened since the 2019 US Open, but it has not gone smoothly since. And I think every time we see these new players emerge, there is that lingering question in the back of our minds. And I mentioned it last week, that is this a one-hit wonder? Will we see them again at this level? But in terms of Emma, it seems like there is a level of confidence we haven't seen before.
Well, to not be a very good podcast host, I will give you an honest answer here. I don't think we know.
It's fair.
I really don't think we have any idea to predict the future, because we were all sitting here and having no real sense that Emma Raducanu was going to come through and win this title the way that she did. If you evaluate what she did at the US Open, I think you can project out and sort of pick any version of the future, which she could be a multiple major winner on every surface. She looks like she has the game that she's capable of doing that. At the same time, we've seen the struggles that Bianca Andreescu has had. We've seen the struggles that someone like Yelena Ostapenko has had as well. So it's not entirely surprising that this could be a one-slam wonder, as Amy was mentioning as well. Like, we've had a number of them over the years, but if you're sitting here and asking me now whether Emma Raducanu is capable of being a superstar and projecting out into the future, absolutely. There's everything there that you could like about her game and her ability to translate on surfaces. Like, we saw what she did at Wimbledon already in her first Grand Slam, and she could have gone deeper in that had she not had the struggles that she'd had in her match against Tomljanovic as well. So I'm totally with you in that regard. I think she probably is the leader in the clubhouse in that regard, but I mean, take your pick. You really have a lot to choose from. And in a lot of ways, that is both exciting for the sport and is also interesting to analyze, as Amy has outlined, whether or not parity in that regard is good for the game in terms of watchability and in terms of the rivalries that you want to see. I think it's fascinating.
And that's a much different story if 3 years down the road, Layla and Emma are playing in their fourth final and they have established themselves as superstars. And then these questions that we have now have been answered with authority. But I think you're both right. You're both right to be apprehensive. I might have been getting too hyped, and I apologize for that. But I would like to say there was some serendipity. Tosin beat Ostapenko today, which we mentioned, Elena Ostapenko winning that French Open out of nowhere, and Tosin beat Raducanu in August at Chicago in a challenger event, which is, again, nuts that Emma Raducanu ended up winning the US Open a few weeks later. But again, what a few weeks. Quick fire here, guys. Davis Cup is underway. These are qualifiers for, I believe, the next World Group next year. So this is not the main competition that's going to be in Madrid in a few weeks' time towards the end of the year. But it's really hard to figure out what's going on in the Davis Cup. It's really hard to figure out who is playing, what the stakes are, what it matters for what nation. I was following India's tie with Finland and could barely get my head around what the stakes were for India going forward, in terms of now they've lost and they have to get into some other world of qualifying. But I wonder, do you blame Gerard Piqué and Cosmo Simon for this, or is this just the Davis Cup has to be reworked entirely?
Well, what a question to throw at someone. It's incredibly challenging to the answer. It's never been straightforward.
Right, that is
I'm
fair.
Sorry, like, it's never been that straightforward to get your head around what this Davis Cup is supposed to look like. And it's one of those that you really should, in the sport of tennis, and especially when you can consider it isn't, it's a global sport, and the way that it lines up is that having nations play against each other should be incredibly easy for everyone to get their heads around. And I'm not convinced it ever has been that way ever since. I mean, the easiest explanation I can give on this is try going to your sports buddy who watches tennis for the Grand Slams and not the rest of the year, and try and explain to them how the Davis Cup works. And if they don't get it within the first 30 seconds, you've basically lost as an event. And I think that's kind of the situation with it. And like, we've talked about this before at length. We go onto the website, we go into the Davis Cup, and we try and figure out how this stuff works. Like, who's playing, what the repercussions are, where this goes into. And it's really bloody hard. It's really difficult. Yeah. It shouldn't be the case with what is supposed to be the premier sports event, tennis event on a global stage. It's a bit of a nightmare.
To the point when Diego Schwartzman lost to Daniil Ostapenkov, I thought it was a formatting error on the site in which Medvedev and Ostapenko's name was improperly inserted into a bot-created article. But no, that happened. Amy, I'm curious as well, because In that Marty Fish documentary, which is great on Netflix, the Davis Cup was a huge part of it, and the Americans being awesome at it and having these legends take part in it. It is a bit strange to see where it is now. And I'm curious from an American's viewpoint, what your take on it is.
First of all, rarely do I agree with someone as much as I agree with what Simon just said. I mean, that is so rare for me. I was at a cocktail party last night, and someone asked me about the Marty Fish documentary. And the other person that was talking to us did not know who Marty Fish was. And this is a tennis fan, like a player.
Right.
And certainly might know that it's involved with the sport of tennis, but would not know who's in it, who's won. I mean, you're talking about a very, very niche area of the sport that the average sports fan in the United States could not care less about. That being said, there's real potential here. I mean, look at how popular the World Cup is, and even some of like the Euros in the United States were hugely popular this year. My son was like glued to it. So there's tremendous potential and opportunity. But how many times have we seen this? The sport of tennis cannot get organized. There's no centralization. Like, guys, give me one cup. Okay. One cup.
Just one. Right.
And put the men and women together, by the way, right, because people like that. They like the glamour of that. And, you know, you might have something, but no, the way it's organized right now, it's a mess. But, you know, there's hope. It could be they could get it together and revitalize it at some point. But even I don't pay much attention to it. And I live and breathe tennis.
Well, that's the biggest indictment there. And you're right. Perhaps it does change when we get to Madrid and all the players are there and the stakes are a bit higher. But I think you guys have hit it. And in Gerard Piqué's defense, which I rarely come to on this show, I think the Laver Cup starting was the death knell, really, for the Davis Cup and like this cup iterations going forward. Because instead of narrowing it down to one cup or maybe two, we're just growing and we'll have 7 to 8 and it'll be insane and we won't have any idea what's happening. But let's hope that maybe there was a plan being devised in back rooms, like there was a plan devised by the ATP and their new strategic plan. We'll talk about some of the details involved in that, plus a special open era election edition, and of course it's our parting shot. So stick with us, we're coming back next on Open Era. Welcome back to the Open Era podcast. I mentioned it in the last segment, the ATP releasing their new strategic plan the board has agreed upon. I think the biggest takeaways, top line, more 12-day Masters events, including the one in Canada, which is exciting for us up here, but less jammed into a week, less worrying about the weather, which I think is constantly a thing, but that was very interesting. There was some behind-the-fold stuff in terms of profit sharing, long-term prize money levels, and expanding more tournaments that include challenger events as well during these ATP Masters events, which I think is really cool. But these things that they've been working on, quote unquote, behind the scenes that we've been asking for, Andre Gaudenzi and crew. I'm curious, top line, what you took away from this, Amy. I think the idea of having longer Masters Series tournaments appeals to me. I always thought that they should take higher precedence than they currently do, and doing it this way will help that.
You know, I'm probably one of the few people that has gone through and read the entire thing. And
Thank you.
I've also read the PTPA, their questions that they submitted, and, you know, the response and the whole nine yards. And I've looked at the financials Don't I have fun hobbies, you guys?
Amazing. You're on the right show. I'll tell you that.
It's a no-brainer move, and it's a great move, and good for them for expanding the Masters 1000s, because there is a little bit of money there, and this will help the players, and it seems like Gaudenzi is trying to get organized with it all. But in comparison to the money that's at play in the Grand Slams, it's like a couple grains of sand in the sandbox.
Right.
I mean, you're not, and then as you go down the line, like the 500s and the 250s, sometimes you're dealing with so little money that it's actually negative money. Like they're losing money. They're not making any money. And what is, how do you profit share off of negative $500,000. That aspect of it is really good. I think where the tours really need to get it together is figuring out how to balance things with regard to the slams, because you're literally talking about billions of dollars there. And the profit sharing and the supporting of the lower tours and the potential of the men's and women's tour either combining or really working together a lot more closely than they do now, like formally and officially, not just saying they work together. That's where, you know, do something with that and I'll really feel good about where things are headed.
I think I'm with you there, and I'm trialing this, and I'll trial this with you, Simon, as a soccer fan as well. But it feels like the Slams have kind of reached this super club status, like your Bayern Munich or Manchester City or Paris Saint-Germain, where they're so big and they kind of absorb everything around them, that everything is kind of tailored towards them as well in terms of how the game is operated. And I think we've seen that in tennis in terms of the calendar and who's moving what and who takes precedence over who. And I wonder how you rein that in. How do you rein in the Slams who have developed this power that Amy's talked about?
I don't think you do. I think that's the unfortunate part about it, is that they are an entity which is so big and powerful at this point that it's going to be very, very challenging and difficult to get them back into a position where they do answer to the structures and the ATP in its current format. I mean, we saw what happened during COVID of effectively the French Open and Wimbledon both just unilaterally making decisions and telling the ATP afterwards, which is kind of where they are at. I actually do think these plans are relatively decent, I have to say. I think they're working with something which, as a model, seems a little more sustainable. It's difficult. It's just a really challenging position. I think it's interesting that they chose to go much more in line with what Indian Wells and Miami had, because having that second week, or at least the last few days of it, incorporated into some more 250 events, I think does make a little more sense in terms of structuring the sport. I just think there's a wider plan necessary here. And Amy touched upon the need for a unified tour on both the ATP and the WTA side. I completely agree. And this really should be the first point to talk about when that happens, is how does revenue sharing work and how does the actual structure of the tour work? Because there's a lot to be hashed out. And this kind of feels like the first step in that, of at least trying to make a structure which is a bit more fair across the board. But also, they got a long way to go, and this seems like a pretty small step in what has to be a pretty major overhaul.
I'll agree, and I think what I found interesting as well is at the bottom, they mentioned the ATP media, the broadcast arm of the ATP, and how it is currently structured and how they kind of want to change it, which is basically getting tournaments to sort of relinquish their media rights back to the ATP, which I didn't know really that was the way it currently was constructed, and it seems really backwards. So I think like these are things that should have happened probably a while ago. So I think small steps indeed, but they are steps being taken, which I think can be a positive. But it is a bit of the waiting game as we see how this will affect the tour going forward. All right, I should explain, folks, what I meant by our election segment. If you are in Canada and you're listening to this on Monday, we are voting in our federal election. I will skip the spiel about what's going on in terms of who is leading, and I will leave my politics out of it for once. Simon, you can do what you want. But what I wanted to do, friends, is vote for who we think should be the leaders of the respective tours in terms of players, because we just talked about the ATP and the PTPA and everything that's going on in that realm and how much we have to wrap our heads around that. But going forward, I wonder if there is something besides how the ATP has their player council, and I know we've had some of the big guys lead that. I'm curious who you would select from the ATP to lead the players among the current crew of people active, Amy. I know it's a tough question, but is it Novak for you as well?
You mean like lead the player council, that kind of thing?
As in if they had like a president of the ATP, but they had to be a player.
Yeah, it would be Andy Murray, easy. In fact, I think that the two tours should combine and he should run both of them. he's somebody who gets it. Now, I don't know how he is with management, like people management and that kind of thing. You know, people get degrees in that and masters and they study it for years and years. And I doubt that Andy has, you know, that capability, but he could probably learn because he's a smart guy. And I just think he's somebody who really gets it. He'd be great. He has my vote for both tours.
Andy Murray, that's a great shout. Bush?
I mean, I'm boring. It's the same answer. You read my mind going into this one. I got to try and come up with something off the top of my head. I was going to pick Ash Barty on the WTA side. I think she talks extremely well for the world number one. Not just the fact that she is the world number one, but she also has some very, very sensible opinions about the sport. Seems very level-headed and someone who, whenever she talks, I tend to listen as well. And that's, we're incredibly lucky to have that in our sport in general, to have the world number one be someone who is such a good spokesperson for the WTA in general. So I know it's a little bit boring, but I'm going to take Barty and Murray.
Great show. The Murray pick is beyond wise, and I'm a bit jealous I didn't come up with that. I was going to choose players that have kind of been on both ends, because I think something that the ATP Player Council got right was having players represented at the very top, in the middle, and kind of closer to the bottom. I think the problem was they didn't really have anyone representing the real rank and file. And I wonder if you could get someone that's seen it all and been in every situation, it's kind of risen to the upper parts of the game. But I see Richard Gasquet playing in a challenger event this week. And I feel like that's someone that has their eyes, their pulse on the game as well, to go along with Amy's point. So I wonder, mainly we're picking from people on the men's side who have been around a while and have played and seen a lot of the game. But I'm curious what that means for the future going forward in terms of who will be the leaders on the tour who are like age 25 and under. Because I don't see any like extremely prime candidates. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, I mean, I have some really probably unpopular opinions about how the lower tours are run. And, you know, I just feel like there shouldn't be thousands upon thousands of people that make a living at professional tennis. And that the guys in the middle that you mentioned, those are the guys that are suffering the most, and women. Those are the people that are suffering the most because they're not getting the support that they deserve based on their results. And there seems to be this rush to really support the low, low echelons. And of course, the tippy, tippy top, they don't need any support. They're multi-millionaires. So if I were to, you know, pick somebody to restructure, it would probably be somebody who has the best interests of that middle group, you know, from about ranking 100 to 20 in the world.
That's fair. I think that is maybe unpopular for some, but I think if we're looking at the money involved in tennis and where they are hemorrhaging money or just simply having to kind of pay to put things on, which you mentioned, Davey, in terms of coming way in the red and not making anything close to a profit, these conversations have to be had. But they are uncomfortable. Speaking of uncomfortable conversations, I thought we were done with the toilet break conversation for a while, but we're not. We must address, it seems like they will acknowledge that there is a problem. Quote, an unnamed official told Reuters, "I hope that before the next season begins in January, we will have a stricter rule." We heard ideas and having strict time limits and availabilities. But I'm curious, Amy, what your take on this brouhaha was.
Yeah, it's a legit brouhaha. It's one of those things that everybody's looking for an edge if you're a competitor. And several years ago, it was the retirements thing. Like, you could show up for a match at the Grand Slam, play a couple of games, retire, and take home an outrageously high paycheck. And they had to nip that in the bud. And they did. They did. And they, you know, changed the rule and restructured where that's just not possible to do that anymore. And guess what? Those retirements stopped, and it really helped the sport. And now nobody really talks about it. Same deal here. And it's not just the bathroom breaks. It's also the medical timeouts and when they are taken. And I don't know if you guys happen to see the Ostapenko-Tomljanovic match at Wimbledon. That was, to me, one of the most egregious right. medical timeout situations. They got to fix this, you know, because the players are kind of like children. They'll just keep abusing it and abusing it and abusing it until somebody changes the rule. So I'm happy to see that they've got a handle on it and they're working on it.
Simon, I think we bemoan that it became such a huge deal, but I think the competitive edge factor that Amy mentioned is huge. And Stefanos kept doing it because it kept working. And I feel like that is the statement that we have to underline here, is that it does give players an advantage. But I wondered, like, how far do we go here? Like, are we doing this NFL style where you have like coaches challenges, but now it's like a certain amount of timeouts you can use? Like, what would you introduce?
I don't know. I'm one of those people that's not particularly against the idea of flat 3 minutes between change of set. I have to say, like, the idea of having inbuilt like structure that's like universal in the sense that everyone kind of knows what the rules are. There's no extension to it or anything. And effectively, if you're not good to go at the end of those 3 minutes, then, you know, tough in that regard, especially with bathroom breaks as well, which is end of the set, regardless of what the result is or anything happens, you have your 3 minutes. And the same thing is true across the board. And I know people will talk about it, extending the length of matches, but at the same time, like, it's good to have a little bit of a reset in general. Like, we do the same thing in other sports. We have, you know, for goodness sake, we have 15-minute halves in football, and we have mm-hmm. breaks at halftime in the NFL, and the same with the NBA as well. So it's not like there isn't precedent for this happening within the sport. The MTO one, goodness me, that is a kettle of fish that you need to get stuck into. Pretty much everything in this episode has been, yeah, we need to come back and have a big think about this and revisit it in a wider conversation, because this is like trying to completely re-examine what our sport is from the ground upwards. And this is one of those things that we have seen people take advantage of this rule. And I think it actually does take a council of people who are looking out for the best interest of the sport, and people who are from number one in the world all the way down to number 500 in the world, because this stuff does trickle down through all levels of the sport, from challenger to futures to ITF, all the way. So, and even juniors, right? Like, people coming up at rec level, they will use the same things if they see it done
right.
at a professional level. So, I mean, yeah, not easy. Definitely not easy to get this one correct. I'll leave it up to a council of players who is not me. How about that?
It's fair. It's usually the good cough out. I also wonder, like, if we look into the future, are we relying on the physio people to tell us if people are faking, which I think is a whole other issue, where these two physios are touring with the players as well and have relationships with them, and now are tasked with being like, well, I think that person is straight up lying and not hurt at all. They should be reprimanded. Is that the enforcement going forward? I think it is quite tricky, but I'm left with the Raducanu MTO at the end of the women's final, and the fact that it was within the rules and perfectly normal and fine, and Leila Fernandez was not happy about it. And I think perhaps that was a misreading of the rules as well. But I think the moment also was a bit hampered by that. And I think that was a tough situation as a fan to watch if you weren't super into tennis, if that makes sense to you guys. Like, if you're just watching as a sports fan, you're asking, why is there this break? And how do we explain this? How do we keep the momentum? So I don't know if that you can address someone bleeding randomly. Like, how do you fix that? But I thought it was a bit of a momentum killer. And I think the 3-set break or 3 minutes break at the end of the sets is a huge marketing opportunity for sponsors. And we know tennis loves sponsors. So why wouldn't they do that? Simon, that's easy money.
Or did that medical timeout in the US Open final elevate those final minutes?
The fact
that how dramatic it was. I'm just playing devil's advocate here. It did make it a bit ridiculous, that final sort of 15 minutes of it. But it certainly got to me, I have to say, as someone who is really having a very neutral interest in a final, someone who owns both British and Canadian passports, I was lucky enough to be right down the middle in that final. So I was just rooting for more. That's what I was rooting for.
Well, I think we're left with not some of the same questions, but we're asking for leadership from the governing bodies of tennis, and there are some plans in motion, but it's a big mountain to climb to be frank, Amy. I think there's a lot of work to be done, but I think the base is solid. It's just a question of how we can build around this to elevate the game.
We have the best sport. I mean, make no bones about that. It's and we're not looking to change the scoring system, although I guess some people are. But, right.
But Patrick Portagalu. Yeah, yeah.
We have the sport that if you play it, you live longer. And there are so many compelling personalities and reasons to watch that I believe that things will get better, but it really all does come down to centralized leadership. And I think that the players have more power than they're using. That's why I kind of like the idea of the PTPA. And I know that they were heavily criticized when they first started, in my opinion, unduly so. But it seems like that they're beginning to make their mark, because they did get this plan delayed when it was going to be voted on, and they have opened up a dialogue now with the ATP. So I'm hoping that they're able to use that power for the good, and that it will eventually lead to more centralized leadership.
Well said, and agreed. Agreed. They have some time, not really. I think everything in 2022 has to be pretty much locked, but we'll see where this goes from here. When we come back to wrap up this episode of Open Era, as always, it's our parting shots coming up next. Welcome back to the Open Era podcast. It is time for our parting shots. Simon, you said you had access to the internet, but I'm curious, what was the first thing you went to read when you were able to get back online?
Ugh. Well, the Giants played this week and they sucked, so that was bad. Let's think, what else? I got inundated with messages about the Met Gala, so I managed to scroll through a bunch of photos, which was always very exciting. I got a bunch of people messaging me about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's dress as well, and right, asking my opinions on that, so that was an interesting one to log back onto and wonder what the hell had gone on in the world. Just this sort of stuff had happened, so it's probably a good place to start. The Met Gala did happen this week, and a bunch of our favorite players showed up in some pretty damn good-looking outfits.
They did. They did. Right after the US Open, we saw the stars, Leila Fernandez, Emma Raducanu. We saw the GOAT vets. Venus was there. Serena was there. Venus and Serena met up with Maria Sharapova, which I thought was really cool, for a cool photo. But I think the tennis vibes are perfect for the Met Gala, Amy. I think it is the perfect synergy of two brands coming together.
I guess so. And I look, I love fashion. I'm one to talk. But do you know what my parting shot was going to be?
Please.
Stay out of the Met Gala. Tennis players, focus on your
perfect
game. Like, right after the US Open, I don't want to see you guys in weird costume stuff at the Met Gala. I really want to see you, you know, focused on tennis. But look, that's me being kind of a curmudgeon. I don't know. I think Naomi Osaka was one of the MCs of the thing, if that's,
right,
you
right
know. So I don't know. I, as much as I like fashion, I'm not a huge fan of that event. And I don't want it to trample on my tennis. So that's my parting shot.
It's fair. It's unexpected, but it's fair. And it's also, I cringed a bit. I cringed looking at some of the photos. Again, it's their lives and they can do what they want and they're having fun. But also I'm like, what are you wearing? Or what is that? I love the the Matteo Berrettini photos of him looking a bit bewildered about where he was or what was happening. I think we could feel that for him. But it is, I think it's the Roger Federer, Anna Wintour connection that has gone beyond them and has now brought everyone in. And everyone was there at the Met Gala to soak that all in. But I wanted to mention off the back of that, in terms of marketing and the Met Gala, I don't really know it's for charity, but I think this is all about like growing brands and growing designers. But Emma Raducanu Bush is on the road to being marketed the hell out of, pardon my English there. But the latest development in the UK, she's trademarked her name. Is that correct?
Certainly is. We got into an interesting discussion on the Discord about this, and you and I had some interesting discussions back and forth about how unnatural some of this stuff has been coming out the back of the US Open. And I don't want to sound like a cynic. I really don't, because I want to acknowledge that I'm bringing some of my own bias and baggage into this and take whatever I say with a grain of salt. But this does feel a little practiced, and it does feel a little plastic, the follow-up to her US Open and some of the things that she's done in terms of like visiting the stock market, getting the name trademarked, the appearances that she's made, the way that she holds and presents herself. It does all feel a little bit like some marketing agency is pushing this very heavily. And I think some of that has to do with who the people are surrounding her. And that's not just Max Eisenbud. It's just like the whole industry of things that are pushing her. And you kind of just wonder if this felt like the same thing as, you know, your Harry and Meghan thing, where it wasn't really it was a tell-all, but really what it was the launching of a celebrity in the United States. And the same thing is kind of true here. It felt like the US Open was the launch of a brand, as opposed to a player winning a US Open and achieving their dreams. And that's an incredibly cynical take on it, and I very much acknowledge that point. But you kind of have to look at it as an entity of how this has actually gone since that point. And it does feel, I use that word again, very practiced. So I don't know. Feel free to hate me. Feel free to tweet at me on Twitter and tell me I'm wrong. No. That's where I kind of feel like about it.
You know what I couldn't help but remember was in the Naomi Osaka doc, when she had an event with the IMG partners, and I thought it was going to be like a marketing thing, but they announced who her coach was at this marketing event. And I was like, what's happening here? But it was IMG backed and it was IMG related. And you're like, okay, IMG is running the show here. And it seems like we're watching kind of an identical scene play out.
I think Simon elucidated perfectly why I'm bothered by the Met thing. And I couldn't quite figure it out until I listened to what he just said. That's why I don't like all of that, because it does feel plastic and rehearsed and like the making of a brand and all that. And boy, that's we saw what happened to Osaka when that stuff took over.
Yeah.
Raducanu, just back to her game for a second. Let's not pretend that she serves and volleys or she plays the net, you know, incredibly well, and she's got this feathery touch, or she could jam the volley with depth. So she's got some work to do, I think. And I do wonder about her game, which she stands close to the baseline sometimes and takes the ball very quickly, which was what Bouchard, you know, did. That's how she did well in her run at Wimbledon. So I think, Emma, I hope she doesn't get wrapped up in all this stuff and that she really makes a concerted effort to diversify her game and work a ton on the court and not get wrapped up in this whole trademarking of her brand.
I just wanted to make the point off the back of that and to acknowledge as well that this is not something that oftentimes gets labeled to male players as well, to recognize where some of this and a lot of the nonsense that's been directed at Emma Raducanu this week as well from various sections of the gutter press, as I will call them. This isn't the same thing that will be. I mean, it's difficult, right? We haven't had an 18-year-old male Grand Slam champion since 2006, 2005, since Rafa did it. So we haven't seen what that beast looks like in the last 17 years or so, but I don't think these same points would be directed towards a male player quite in the same capacity. And it is the fact of who Emma Raducanu is sort of her background as well. So I wanted to take the time to acknowledge that, which is that, yes, my take may be cynical and all those sort of things that come with it, but there is also a cottage industry which exists to try and push and present players, especially female players, that is perhaps a little concerning to me, and I think perhaps concerning to a lot of people who love and watch the sport.
Yeah, well said. I think that's bang on. Moving on to those cups, we mentioned too many cups and Davis Cup being a bit of an afterthought these days, but the 2021 Laver Cup will start on Friday. Who needs this? I'm not quite sure, but the folks in Boston will be treated to this cup event. Nick Kyrgios says it's his favorite week of the year. I know their social media team is getting this hyped up like crazy, but the problems with this event I think that we outlined before remain. There's no women representation here. If you mention Alexander Zverev and the allegations against him to the Twitter account, you'll get blocked. I think that is their social media strategy at this point, just not acknowledging it. But without the big guys, without Federer, I think the Laver Cup in general has some problems. But now when you look at it as I'm not quite sure what this is. I'm curious what you guys, how you guys view the Laver Cup as it stands in 2021.
I have a question. Is Federer not going to be there at all, even as like an ambassador or has he said?
I am not sure yet. I don't think they've indicated for sure if he's going to be there or not. I'm assuming no.
Then I think they've got a public relations problem. And I wonder how much interest there will be. I mean, I've been to the event, I've covered the event, and I got to tell you, they do a first-class job and they think of everything. And the way that the tournament presents itself, both in person and on TV, is something that even the Grand Slams could learn from what they're doing. But that being said, you got to have the players and you got to have that panache. And, you know, without Rafa, Roger, or Djokovic, I'm just not sure. You know, there's Ryder Cup and there's, you know, NFL football and there's other things for me to watch. So I'm just not sure how well it's going to do.
Okay. Hands up, everyone out there who's listening to this podcast. Hands up, who got blocked by the Twitter account? I did. Proud of it.
Did you get blocked?
I got blocked this morning. It happened, which probably goes to show you what I think about this event.
We worked for a very big company, EA, and we ran their social media accounts. That was not the option one on the manual of what to do when encountering controversial views on social.
So, I mean, you're alluding to it. I received some pretty awful things directed in our towards us when we were in charge of those social media accounts. I never blocked a single person, and I never was told by anyone inside of that company to ever block someone or to directly, not challenge anyone or mute anyone in that capacity. This feels like quite a different strategy in that regard. This is really tone deaf, and if they thought this was going to go away, this has just poured fuel on a fire that everyone inside of the ATP is doing a terrible, terrible job in trying to douse, because this is only going to get worse for them. And I don't care from the standpoint, from a PR standpoint, I care that they actually do something about it. And this is not just people, tweeting angrily on Twitter. It's like we're doing it because we want to see some actual change and we want to see this dude held accountable for it. So that's why it's happening.
So you guys got blocked because, I mean, I know that people were getting blocked because they tweeted the Slate story. Is that why you got blocked, or was there another reason?
That's why I got blocked. I just replied to the photo of Alexander Zverev with the account from the Slate article, and that's it. And that was the reason, I guess, that I got blocked.
It sounds like the virtual equivalent of like going to a protest and holding your hands up and saying, put handcuffs on me and go ahead and arrest me.
Also of note, because of the legal standing or what's happening with that case, you can't view that Slate article in Germany right now. I saw a screen grab. It's Renny Dunfield was in Austria. You can view it there. And then when you're changing your VPN to Germany because of the legal issues right now, I think it says this tweet has been withheld in Germany in response to a legal demand, which I had not seen before. I really didn't understand how involving players in the WTA has not been addressed yet, considering everything else they've done so well, Amy, because I think, like you mentioned, I've watched it and loved it. I've watched the drama. I've watched Nick Kyrgios play out of his skull for a few minutes and be like, this is great, this is awesome, and get totally sucked in. But I'm curious for how well they do everything else. Why haven't they addressed this yet?
Yeah, because if you look at the lineup, Team World is pretty weak this year. So, I mean, it seems like Team Europe is going to like crush. So if it's a legitimate competition and it's kind of a blowout, then there's really no reason to watch. And, you know, you throw women in the mix and, you know, there's storylines and there's, especially if they play mixed doubles. And it's entertaining, but they'll figure that out. teammate will for sure figure out, hey, you know, Laver Cup got lower ratings this year. Maybe next year we'll add women, you know? That's probably, if I had my crystal ball, that's probably in the planning for next year.
They need some data points, is what you're saying.
I think you're
right. Quick shout out, Simona Halep got married, just to her. Do not know her personally, but always seems like one of the better people on tour. And we're big fans of Darren Cahill as well. So shouts to Simona Halep for getting hitched to a non-tennis player, which I guess is a thing people can do now because it seems like everyone is hitching or shacking up, as they say, in the tennis world. That is my final parting shot. Do you guys have anything else? Simon, do you have anything?
Other than to say, not to bring fashion back into it, an incredible dress from Simona Halep.
It was.
Gold.
It was, yeah.
You don't see that very often as a wedding dress. I thought she looked awesome in it. So great stuff.
Amy, anything else that's gnawing at you that you want to settle some scores or get
no,
it up there?
I'll just, you know, like I used to work in television and I will give you guys kind of a tease, I guess. I'll give you two things. Number one, I would love to come back on a future episode and just really talk about the Zverev thing because I have a slightly different take on the whole thing. Growing up, my mother was a criminal defense attorney, and I grew up around cases like this, her cases that she had all the time. So I think my view on the whole thing is slightly different, and I would love to come on a future episode and just talk about what was in the article and that kind of thing. And then the other thing is I'm working on a piece for later this week. I'm not sure where it's going to be published yet, on what is going to happen with the Australian Open this year and how the Tennis Australia is dealing with the government there to figure out if there's going to be a quarantine, vaccination status, and the decisions that the players will have to make.
That'll be a must read for sure. I feel like that is not being discussed enough at this point, but it surely will be.
Yes. And they're working on it and they're floating some things, which are really interesting.
You mentioned teammate, but I feel like Craig Tiley and that crew is also pretty innovative when it comes to figuring out solutions. So it'll be fascinating to see how they can operate. I'm not sure if you guys know off the top of your head where Australia is at vaccine wise, but I think they're slowly getting closer to where we are in North America. Hopefully that bodes well for January. That's awesome. Looking forward to that, Amy. Also, we can find your stuff everywhere, basically, but you're on Twitter at Amy Lundy Doll and on YouTube, Three, A Tennis Show, correct?
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Awesome. Okay. Simon, I know we do two challenges remaining, our special non-tennis related segment. Do you have anything from the wilderness that you can report back?
It's funny because second week in a row, I'm picking Ted Lasso because I binge watched season one on the plane and then I binge watched season two whilst I was in Britain. It's really interesting. Who thought season two would go in the direction that it did?
No spoilers, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I definitely won't spoil anything, but I will say it's a very good show that is far better than people think it is because it's very, very well written and very well acted. And I think this one's going to be dissected for the next 10 years when people who do analysis of TV shows.
High praise. The manager of my favorite club, Arsenal, Mikel Arteta, says he watches it, which I thought was kind of interesting. Also, like, should you be watching this? I'm not sure if it's helpful, but everyone loves it. It's across all generations. Ted Lasso, I don't really have a strong parting shot this week. I just wanted to shout out the week after a major, that feeling of kind of just like settling after what we've just witnessed and kind of reassessing where we're at. I felt like this week was way different than normal just because of how nutso the US Open was and kind of where we're left with kind of history unachieved just at this point. So it was a bit of an exhale and wow, what a year it's been. And there's still more tennis because somehow Indian Wells is coming up in the future in a few weeks, which we'll be talking about. Shirley, Amy.
Yes.
Open invitation. You are welcome back anytime. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. What an enjoyable discussion. Thanks, guys.
For Simon and for producer Clay, as always on the ones and twos, thank you so much for listening to Open Era. You can find us on Twitter at Open Era Pod, as well as patreon.com/Open Era. Join us there. You get the show ad free. You can join us on the Discord, which Bush mentioned, where we're talking tennis all the time. Sorry. Plus, you get the show a bit early on Sunday, so it's a pretty good deal. Join us there. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you, as always, for listening to Open Era.